I stood at the top of the Prince of Thieves cargo ramp and checked my gear. Everything was right where it had been when I checked it the minute before. I was as ready as I was ever going to be. I looked at my watch. It still said it was 10:42 p.m. on Thursday, September 29th, but it was on Worcester time, to be 8:42 here. Or down there, anyway. Up here, it didn't really matter. I turned to the person next to me and asked, "Are you sure you want to do this?" Thanks to my radio headset, I didn't have to yell, though the plane's cargo cabin was full of the roar of wind and the drone of engines. The person I was speaking to had a headset too, but she didn't answer me verbally. She just tugged one of the straps of her harness a little tighter, then gave me a huge grin, her teeth and eyes glinting scarlet in the red glow of the get-ready light. Not for anything like the first time, I remarked to myself that my recently acquired apprentice was a strange, strange child, and one who bore close watching. Fearlessness is handy, but it can get a person into a world of trouble. I've done a lot of things in my life that weren't legal, but today I was breaking new ground. If taking a minor into a potential combat situation is reckless endangerment, and it is, I don't even want to think about what getting her there by jumping out of an airplane is. I sighed to myself and turned to look out and down. Silly, really. I couldn't see my target. A, by the time it would be visible from this doorway, I'd better not be standing here. And B, there was nothing to see out there but nighttime. Hitting a specific spot on what is, let's face it, an inconveniently big planet from a moving airplane is a tricky business. If your drop aircraft is off course by just a little bit, or you jump at the wrong time, you miss. If your target is near water, and that happens, you could end up taking a swim. If you happen to be parachuting among huge, craggy mountains and that happens, you might find the ground a lot closer than you were expecting. Or even, if you're very unlucky, ride your drop aircraft into a cliff. Nothing I could do about any of that, though. I'd just have to trust Zoner to get me to the right spot at the right time, and then it'd be my turn to do the rest. The light above the door turned green, and for a moment I didn't have time to think anymore. "Let's go," I said to Sakura, and then I flipped my goggles down and stepped into the night. Suddenly it was very quiet indeed. As I plummeted toward, I hoped, the province of Alberta, I still didn't have time for a lot of rumination. While the icy wind snapped at my clothes and the glowing dial of the altimeter on my wrist wound down, I only had one stray thought. How did I get into this again? Airy Productions Unlimited presents Street Fighters Warrior's Legacy, Battle 06, Independence, by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that's me. With the aid of Philip J. Moyer, Laura Roxanne was created by Lawrence R. Mann. It was Monday, September 26th. It was cool in Worcester. I was working the day watch out of my little office off the kitchen, thumbing through the mail and considering my situation. And there was much about it, or at least one big thing about it, I didn't like. When we got home from London 6 weeks ago, I spent a couple of days in a funk, and the rest of the time in a corner. When I have a problem, a big problem, I mean, I can do one of two things. I can figure out a strategy, and then handle it, or I can find a bunch of other things to do, do them, and ignore it, hoping it'll just resolve itself or go away. I recognize that the latter is a bad habit, and most of the time I can consciously overcome it. In this case, I failed, though in my defense, that wasn't simply for lack of trying, like it would have been in the old days. It was just that there wasn't a lot I could do about whatever the hell happened to Cammy and me, besides mull it over. It was never a normal relationship. Me living in Massachusetts and her living in Scotland pretty much precluded that, even if she hadn't been a special agent for the British government. But the last time I'd been in London, the new director of Secret Intelligence, M, her overall boss in SIS, had forbidden her to see me anymore. When I protested that that was a damn shabby move, Cammy came out to the lobby of SIS headquarters, told me she never wanted to see me again, and left. If I hadn't been so preoccupied, I might have realized how strange and weird and out of character that was. As it was, all I realized at that particular moment was that it hurt. Hurt terribly. Hurt more than I had thought I could be hurt. After all, it's not like we had any great towering romance going on. We were sort of buddies with snogging privileges. I was always pleased to see her, but I hadn't even realized how badly I'd fallen for her until she looked at me so coldly and told me never to show myself around her again. In the old days, I'd just have quit the field at that point. No sense in putting yourself forward if you're not wanted, after all. Now, I at least had the nous to realize that the whole thing had been too damn peculiar to be what it looked like on its face, and I surely had the motivation to look into it further. The problem was that, while the direct approach hadn't got me very far at all, apart from nearly getting me into a gunfight with the British Army, circumspection didn't make for a ton of progress either. Zoner and I put feelers out to all our own contacts in the intelligence scene, asking whether they had any information, but all we got back was a lot of shrugs and apologies. Whatever SIS had Cammy doing, whatever reason she might have had for cutting me loose like that, it was buried very deep, so deep that not even her former teammates at Unit Delta Red, whom I reached through my contacts with Spectrum, had any idea what had become of her. And if they didn't know, odds were the only people who did were this new DSI in her inner circle. The only hint of an in there I had was with Lawrence Bowen, and he'd dropped off the grid as well, presumably sent on another mission as soon as he could be turned around. Zoner's contacts came up just as empty. He'd burned most of his outstanding favors, setting up TACAX for Meg Bennett, not that I'm complaining. And besides, nobody in the U.S. intelligence or special ops community seemed to know anything about it. Stymied for the moment, the only thing I could think to do was what I'd been trying to avoid doing. Find something else to do, and see if anything developed on its own while I was doing it. So, over the next 6 weeks, I threw myself into Sakura. Let me rephrase that. I spent all of my time working on her. What I mean is, look, I know what you're thinking, and Zoner keeps giving me this irritating little smirk, but really. In that respect, even before we started with the martial arts aspect of it, there was a lot to do. We had rafts and rafts of paperwork to make her officially a member of our household, and that took some doing. She was a foreign national and a minor, disowned by her parents and taken in by a couple of 20-something single men who claimed on their tax returns that they were in the freelance courier business. Even with Zoner's connections at state, and my own with the free and sovereign government of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, that was sure to raise some official eyebrows. We had to soothe the savage breast of the Child Welfare Division and that of the City of Worcester. There were hearings. And there were going to be more of them, before it was all said and done. It turns out that you can't just go to the town office and say, "I solemnly swear that I am not up to any weird shit here." We were, our contact at CWS assured us, exceedingly lucky just to have received the court order authorizing us to foster her while the system worked its way through a final, official determination, which was going to be a long and involved process. Between all that, getting her into school, working out a training regimen for her, engaging her existing skills, I would have been pretty busy even without my admittedly less than entirely successful intelligence gathering project. As it was a good way of getting my mind off my troubles without just hiding under the couch or staying in bed for a month like I would have back in my teenage rebel days. I was still at my desk, having disposed of the mail, when the phone rang. I looked at it, saw that it was my personal line, not the one Zoner and I used for business, so I answered it with a simple, "Hello," rather than the "Trailing Edge Airlines, you call, we haul" shtick.
"Griffin,"
said a voice that was familiar, but that I didn't immediately place. "Speaking?" I said, not sure why I was making it a question.
"This is Bill Guile,"
said the caller. I blinked. Captain William Guile, USAF, was not one of my biggest fans. We had a few friends in common, but tended toward frosty silences on the rare occasions when social currents brought us into proximity. And the last time we'd seen each other, I'd been violating the security perimeter on an Air Force base, and Guile had broken my nose. What on earth could he be calling on my private line for? Hi, Captain. What's up? If you want a rematch for last time, you've got the wrong number. You won that part of the fight. And then Cammy had kicked him around the hangar like a sack of old potatoes, but to my eternal regret, I missed that part on account of being unconscious.
That's not what I'm calling about,
Guile said.
It's about White. I heard she was missing. Wondered if you knew anything.
I blinked, wondering what he was on about, and then remembered that Camilla White was the codename Cammy had been using when she'd infiltrated Area 51. Why do you care? I asked, probably more sharply than I really intended. She kicked your ass for you.
Yeah, well, it could be argued that I was asking for it,
Guile replied with something it took me a few moments to recognize as mild sarcasm.
Point is, we were all kind of at cross purposes that day. I've heard about what you were really there to do, and it sounds like it was for a good cause. I just wish you didn't have to do it on my base. Anyway, what do you know about these rumors I've been hearing? Anything to them?
Well, I don't know where she is. I don't know if that means she's missing, as such. I'm probably the last guy you should ask. And then, without really understanding why I was doing it, I told him all about it. The San Francisco thing, the scene in the lobby of SIS headquarters in London, all of it. I finished my tale of woe with, since then, nothing. Dead ends and closed doors everywhere I look. Wherever they've sent her, they buried it deeper than I can find it.
Huh,
said Guile.
That must be tough. I mean, I've got no way of knowing what you think of her, but the way she tore into me, obvious she's got something pretty big for you.
I stared at the handset for a second. That was simultaneously the best and worst news I'd had in weeks, and the most affecting thing Guile had ever said to me. Then put it back to my head and said, thanks. No, seriously, thank you. I kind of suspected as much, but it's nice to have it sort of confirmed. He chuckled.
No, it's true, all right. You should have seen the look in her eyes. She came in that hangar and saw you laid out on the floor. I haven't worked over like that in a while. Of course, it didn't help that you'd already softened me up.
I said. I was fighting like a fifth grader that day. Dan Hibiki could have done a better job on you.
I don't know if I'd go that far,
he said. And suddenly we were laughing together like old buddies. It was weird. A little creepy. Well, look, you want to do it again sometime when I've had a decent night's sleep and some lunch. I'm game, I heard myself saying.
Might take you up on that,
Guile said.
Tell you what. We do that, we can blank the score from the last one. In the meantime, I'll dig around a little, see what I can come up with. I imagine you've had Charlie look around the Spec Ops community already, but I've got some contacts over at Interpol for my days with Special Investigation. Maybe they know something.
Well, thanks, Guile. I appreciate that.
Not a problem. We might not always see eye to eye, but all three of us are world warriors, right? We have to stick together.
He seemed to get a little embarrassed at that point and finished up briskly.
Anyway, I dig anything up, I'll call you, yeah? In the meantime, hang in there. Guile out.
What a weird way to end a phone call, I thought as the line went dead and I hung up the phone. Must be an Air Force thing. I sat looking out the window for a minute, trying to get my head around the conversation I'd just had. On the one hand, it was great to hear some independent confirmation that Cammy really liked me, particularly to the part of me that will always be in the seventh grade. On the other, that made whatever the hell had happened between us in London that much more painful. I sighed and muttered to the world in general, "Couldn't you at least call?" Somewhat to my surprise, the phone rang again, making me jump a little. I looked. My line again. Picked it up, said hello, and for 3 milliseconds thought she had. But the voice at the other end was lower, mellower, and the accent was English prep school, not Highland Scottish. Lara Croft, world traveler, tressus, adventure archaeologist extraordinaire, was as famous to civilians, that is to say, non-Street Fighters, as anybody in my circle of friends and acquaintances, or at least tied with Ken Masters. But Zoner and I knew her when, before the Discovery Channel series or the improbably dramatized TNT biopic. She was Trailing Edge Airlines' first paying customer. Our very first job was flying her to Peru for what had turned into a three-week extravaganza of Nazis and hidden treasure that had launched her to stardom and me out of college.
"My father's having lunch with the Minister of Defense next week,"
she said after the opening pleasantries.
"I thought I might ask him to pry at the edges of the Official Secrets Act a bit on your behalf."
"Word gets around," I said ruefully.
"You and Zona have put out feelers to a lot of people who know each other,"
she pointed out.
"It was inevitable that some of us would find out we were on the same trail. Though I dare say not everyone is taking the mission quite so personally as I am,"
she conceded. I arched an eyebrow, though she couldn't see me. "And why, I wanted to know, are you taking the mission personally?"
"Because,"
Lara replied bluntly,
"she's the first woman who's been decent to you in 5 years, and I don't want to see you have to start all bloody over again."
From someone else, I might have taken that as an affront, or at least an annoying presumption. But that's the kind of relationship Lara and I have always had. I was walk into a closed patio door smitten with her from the moment I first saw her. 6 years earlier, Boston Logan International Airport. It occurred to me, as we stood just outside the International Terminal's security checkpoint, that we might have a problem. "Zoner?" "Yeah?" "Do you know what she looks like?" No, actually." "Does she have any reason to know what we look like?" "Doubt it." I put my hand to my forehead. "Great." "We should have made a sign," said Zoner, shrugging. "And me without my chauffeur cap." "I guess we could just ask everybody who walks by." "Well, not everybody. I think, for example, we can rule out that gent with the handlebar mustache." "Probably. And anyone under 10 or over 40. Wait, I have an idea. Come on." I turned and led the way back to the baggage claim carousel, moving into position next to the hatchway where the bags first pop into view. An easy enough task since the flight hadn't disembarked yet. "Why," Zoner wondered, "are we hanging around the luggage claim?" "Watch the bags as they come out," I said. "When one comes out with her name on it, see who picks it up." Zoner grinned. "Hey, good idea." He glanced toward the exit, where an airport cop had taken notice of the two guys hanging around the luggage carousel for a flight that hadn't disembarked yet. "Assuming, of course, that security guard doesn't throw us out," he added. The airport cop might have come over and spoken to us, but it was just about then that the actual passengers started arriving, and before long a sizable crowd had formed around the carousel. I leaned against the wall, hands in the pockets of my jeans, and looked them over. Sometimes I like to do a spot of people watching when I'm in a place like an airport that's conducive to it. There were a few middle-aged couples, some arriving from England to begin vacations, some returning. Here and there I saw businessmen in somewhat rumpled suits, holding briefcases and waiting, most likely, for garment bags. Old ladies with blue-rinsed hair and tweed suits, very Miss Marple. A youngish couple with two children so loud and unruly they had to be American. "Wow. Hello." I no longer noticed the other passengers. They were unimportant. For a moment I went blank and completely forgot my mission, my whole reason for being at the airport. My whole attention, the full span of my concentration, was occupied by the young woman who had just emerged from the security checkpoint. The distinction between girls and women is subtle and sometimes difficult to place, and it has nothing to do with age. I've known 30-year-old girls and 14-year-old women. It's largely a matter of her attitude, with external cues carried in her posture, her mannerisms, the way she walks. All of which goes toward explaining why, looking at the person who'd just come out of the security gates, I immediately thought of her as a woman, not a girl, though she couldn't have been much older than me. She was about my height, trim and athletic, her slender build and the very upright way she carried herself giving her the illusion of greater height. She walked with an easy saunter, giving an impression of restrained energy. Her clothes were nothing too special. Gray stonewashed jeans with the cuffs rolled and tucked tight, black Chuck Taylors, and a leather flying jacket with a fluffy sheepskin ruff around the neck, unzipped to reveal a black-flecked gray fisherman's sweater. Her long brown hair was drawn back in a braid. As she entered the baggage claim area, she tipped her John Lennon sunglasses down and surveyed the scene coolly through deep brown eyes. Her gaze raked over the assemblage from right to left, then came slowly back, examining a few notable points in greater detail. I guess I was a notable point. It occurred to me about a half second before that gaze reached me that I was staring, but by the time I thought of it, we'd made eye contact. I'd always thought people who talk about feeling a thrill at moments like that were full of it, but that moment made a believer of me. I fought my instinctive impulse to look away and blush, and instead kept eyes front, smiling acknowledgement and hoping like hell it didn't look like a leer. For a moment, the corners of her mouth twitched down in a faint, contemplative frown. Then she came to some internal decision and smiled at me, before breaking off the momentary contact and plunging into the crowd. I stood there a moment longer, considering the odd sensation that had washed over me when she smiled. I didn't know her at all, and might never see her again, but I felt as if we had connected, on some level, with nothing more than that quiet, steady moment of eye contact. I told myself that was a matter of wishfulness on my part. For some reason, whenever I meet a really attractive woman, my first level of desire is an intense longing to be friends with her. I guess I subconsciously figure I can move on to other things from there. With her disappearance into the crush of passengers at the other end of the carousel, my awareness of the world around me returned abruptly. I felt like letting out the breath I hadn't known I was holding and leaning against the wall for support. Amazingly, Zoner had been watching the luggage emerging from the hatchway the whole time and had missed her entirely. I would have had a difficult time explaining why I'd just nearly swooned, but he hadn't noticed that either. By the time he glanced over at me, I was leaning on the coaming at the top of the carousel's angled conveyor, watching the luggage go by. A black nylon duffel bag, a pair of extremely battered brown hard leather suitcases, much stickered, a yellow Palm Beach overnight bag, not unlike my own, a mid-sized black anvil case. An anvil case. As it passed, I reached down and flicked the handle tag over. L. Croft, it said in a firm but graceful hand, and an address in Northants, England. Bingo, I remarked, and Zoner looked at me. The black anvil case, it's hers. We turned and watched as it trundled down the conveyor, and just as it reached the other end, it was claimed by the woman in the flying jacket. Oh, frabjous day! Kalu, Calais! I raised my hand and caught her eye. She smiled slightly in recognition, then started working her way through the crowd. When she was within earshot, I put out a hand and managed to say without my voice cracking, Hi, I'm Ben Hutchins. Lara Croft, she said, and I wanted to sigh and fall down. It's not just women who love the sound of an English accent. Her grip was warm and strong, but she wasn't looking for a contest of strength, just a greeting. And this must be Megazone, she continued, as Zoner all but climbed over me to get his turn. And over the course of our Peru adventure, she managed to let me down easy with such consummate aplomb that we've been the kind of friends who can talk about any damn thing ever since. She's disapproved of all the girlfriends I've had since, not, as my grandfather says, that they could fill a rowboat, on the grounds that I could do at least as good as her and shouldn't settle. So I said I'd take that as a compliment on Cammy's behalf, and I'd take all the help she could give me, but she shouldn't get her old man locked up in Wormwood Scrubs trying. And she laughed and said the Minister of Defense was her father's fag at Eton, which took me a moment to parse, and wouldn't dare. And then, showing the kind of grace she always had in these conversations, she changed the subject and asked me how I was finding the sensei life. Not bad for something I wasn't looking for, I admitted. Shaping Sakura as a martial artist is turning out to be a bit like that old joke about being a sculptor.
How do you make a statue of Napoleon? simple. You just find a block of stone and chip off everything that doesn't look like him.
Lara said. Yeah, that's the one. What I mean is, I figure what she's ultimately going to be is already inside her somewhere. My job isn't to make her what I think she should be, it's just to help that come out without being distorted, you know? She said she did. That makes my job both easier and harder.
How so?
Well, it's easier in that I don't have to worry much about prescribed moves and techniques. Harder because it means I'm constantly making it up as I go. But it's rewarding work. She's a good student, better than I was afraid she'd be when I agreed to take her on, and her talent's unmistakable. I just hope I'm up to the job of helping her reach her potential, and keeping that potential out of the wrong hands. I sighed. It was a lot easier being the student.
I'm told it usually is. Listen, I have to go. But if Father learns anything, I'll let you know straight away. Good luck with your student. You should bring her by sometime soon. We can put her through my obstacle course.
You know, that's a good idea. We really should. The next day was sunny and breezy, good weather for working outdoors. Sakura got home from school, found the heap of firewood Zona and I had split and left for her to stack, that being a traditional task for martial arts apprentices, and complained that she'd been wanting to spar all day. Since I'm such a softy, I decided she could do the wood after dinner, and we sparred instead. We'd been at it for half an hour or so, not really going at it, but pacing ourselves and having a good time, when she got a contemplative look on her face. "What is it?" I asked, blocking her next punch combo. "I was just thinking about something Zoner said the other day," she replied. "What?" I said, making her duck to avoid my patent-pending double kick. "He was talking on the phone with someone, his girlfriend, I think, and I guess the hearing we had to go to came up. He said he was surprised they'd let me stay here, even, what was the phrase, pending further investigation?" "Well," I allowed, taking one of her high kicks on an upraised forearm, "it is a pretty unusual situation." "That's what Zoner said." She gave me a quizzical look as she swung into a roundhouse kick and asked, "Sensei, who's Nabokov?" I was so startled by the question I completely failed to defend myself and took one of her size 6 Chuck Taylors right in the bread box, entirely unprepared for it. I shrugged off much harder blows, but only when I was ready for them, and the impact drove all the wind out of me, sending me crashing to the grass with a great thundering shocked, Sakura sprang to my side at once, kneeling down next to me. "Oh my god, Sensei, are you all right? What did I do?"
Good hit," I managed to croak. "That's all for now. Please go inside and tell Zoner that I will kill him someday."
She hesitated, biting her lip. "Are you sure? I didn't really hurt you, did I?"
"No, no," I replied. "Just need a little rest. I'm old now and I get tired."
Sakura lingered for a few moments, then got up and, with one last worried look back, went inside the house. I stayed where I was, savoring the return of oxygen to my system. When the momentary discomfort had passed, I just lay there, looking up at the fluffy afternoon clouds and thinking about this and that. Until suddenly the shape of a woman in a dark business suit appeared over me, freakishly distorted by the extremely unusual viewing angle, and said in a clipped English voice, "Caitlin Saunders, SIS. Would you come with me, please, Mr. Hutchins?" I considered the request for a moment, then replied, "No." She blinked. "I'm sorry?" "I said no," I told her. Keeping my tone pleasant and non-confrontational, I explained, "It's the opposite of an affirmative response. In this context, it means that I do not care to go anywhere with you or any other SIS son of a bitch at this time, as it were." "Rather thought you'd feel that way, old boy," said another, familiar voice. I turned my head to see Brigadier Alistair Gordon Lethbridge-Stewart coming briskly toward me at a Batman camera angle, looking out of place in a civilian suit and a camel hair overcoat. For the first time, I noticed that it was getting a little chilly, the autumn afternoon gathering toward dusk. "Brigadier," I said, surprised. "I didn't expect they'd send you if they wanted to talk to me again." Lethbridge-Stewart smiled, opened the gate, and reached down to help lever me to my feet. "Let's take a walk," he said. Then, turning to the SIS officer, he added, "Wait here, Sanders. He won't say a damn thing to me if you're hovering around." "Sir," said Sanders, though she clearly didn't like it. "Where'd you get her?" I inquired as the Brigadier and I walked down the street toward Elm Park. "The evil queen of numbers insisted one of her own people come with me, in case I got up to anything," Lethbridge Stewart replied, speaking the uncomplimentary nickname as if it were an official title. "Don't worry. If she tries to follow us, I'm sure Sergeant Benton will think of some way to keep her busy." I arched an eyebrow. "The evil queen of numbers?" Lethbridge Stewart chuckled. "My little nickname for the new M. Rather caught on around headquarters, I understand, much to her ladyship's chagrin. Bloody bean counter is all she is. If she'd been in charge of unit back in the day, we'd all be speaking Zygonese now, I expect. But I digress." We crossed Russell Street and entered the park, a pleasant, tree-lined expanse of green, designed, incidentally, by none other than Frederick Law Olmsted. "At any rate," he went on, "she's gotten herself into a bit of a mess. And before I can explain what the mess is, I have to give you some background information. And I warn you now, you're not going to like it." And he was right. I didn't like it. I wasn't sure which part of it I didn't like the most. The fact that Cammy was a former Shadaloo agent, or the fact that SIS hadn't seen fit to mention that fact. To her, I mean. It wasn't any great surprise they hadn't mentioned it to me. "M sent her back in?" I asked, incredulous. The Brigadier nodded, frowning. Clearly the idea didn't sit any better with him. "That's crazy," I said. "She has no memory of being a Shadaloo operative, so it's not like she'd know how to fit in among their forces any better than anyone else. And what if she's recognized? Do you even know how senior she was?" "We have some idea. M believes she was part of Bison's inner circle." I blinked. "Oh, wonderful. Not like he's going to wonder where she's been all this time." "M's idea was that she could play the amnesia card." I shook my head. "Who is this woman? Where did she come from? What's her background?" "Lady Barbara Maudsley is an administrator," the Brigadier said. "Not a former special operative like Admiral Messervy. I'm told she's very good at what she does, and I don't doubt it. She doesn't understand the realities of the secret world." "That's obvious," I snapped. "Doesn't she have any idea what Shadaloo is, what Bison is? This isn't some megalomaniacal attention deficit case like Cobra Commander we're talking about here. Bison is one of the most dangerous men in the world, personally, not just politically." "She's realized that, albeit a trifle belatedly," the Brigadier said. I turned to him as something suddenly occurred to me. "Was M responsible for our little scene at headquarters last month?" "Yes. Thought it best for Cammy to break all outside ties before going under, I suppose." "I'm surprised she went along with that," I mused, then added, "and more than a little hurt, she didn't at least try to get word to me that she didn't mean it." "She was afraid you'd get hurt," Lethbridge Stewart told me, his voice gentle. I looked at him in surprise. He nodded. "She believed that if you had any inkling that none of it was her own idea, you'd tear the place apart," he added with a wry smile, "and don't try to deny it." "I damn near did anyway. That..." I searched for a concise way of expressing what I was feeling, didn't find one, and settled for finishing lamely, "Stung." "I've reviewed the security tapes," said the Brigadier. "It appears we've much to thank your young assistant for. At any rate, that's the long and short of it. Cammy hated to do that to you. but she felt it was for the best. Besides which, she was under orders, and whatever else she may be, she's a soldier. Em wanted you gone from the picture before it got complicated. She doesn't like freelancers much. Security risks. I snorted. The Brigadier nodded sympathetically. As I said, she hasn't the background to understand our world. He smiled ironically. But I dare say she's learning. Well, she'd better learn quick, or she's going to get a lot of good people killed. You can't play patty cake with Shadaloo. Quite. Entirely serious now, the Brigadier gave me a long, steady look. Cammy worked for me in unit for 3 years before she was transferred to 00 section. I couldn't be fonder of the girl if she were my own daughter. And now we've lost contact with her. I felt a cold, hollow feeling in the pit of my stomach, even though I'd known that was what Lethbridge Stewart was leading up to all the time. But at the same time... You don't look surprised, he said. I'm not. Look, Brigadier, this may sound crazy, but Bison's not quite human. He has psychic powers. It's said in my circle that he may even be able to read minds, and if that's true... I closed my eyes, forced the words out. Then Cammy's probably already dead. Lethbridge Stewart nodded gravely. That's a possibility. But if she isn't, then you're the only one I can think of who has a chance of getting her out alive. I opened my eyes again, looked at him, and gave a mirthless laugh. That must stick in her ladyship's craw. It does, rather, the Brigadier said, a little mischievous light coming back into his eyes. Damn near killed her to give me the go-ahead to ask you to do this. I had to go through all the files and give her a 2-hour presentation, proving that you and Megazone have been more reliable, more valuable assets to SIS in the past than some of our own top agents. We'd finished our circuit to the park. As we crossed Russell again, Lethbridge Stewart added, She didn't want to believe it, but she did. Give her credit where it's due. She believes in information. Give her good data, and she'll do the right thing. And I think she was being leaned on by someone highly placed at the Ministry of Defense, but you didn't hear that from me. Do you know where Cammy is? We have a reasonably good idea. When we lost contact with her, M assigned 002 to follow her trail. He made it as far as Calgary before vanishing as well, so we asked the Canadian SIS for help. They assigned one of our best agents to look for the pair of them, and reports indicate that he was captured before he even acknowledged the mission. Chances are CSIS's entire comms network is compromised. Shadaloo knew their man was on his way before he did. At any rate, from his last known location and some surveillance data we, borrowed from our American friends, we were able to determine that Shadaloo have a facility in the Canadian Rockies. I blinked. The Canadian Rockies? I parroted. But then something clicked in the back of my head. DRDC used to have a research facility up there back when. Department something. One of those cutesy acronyms that work in English or French. They were screwing around with some kind of super soldier research. The Brigadier hesitated, glancing at me. Yes, I'm surprised you know about that. Blame's owner, I replied, evading the real explanation of how I knew. Lethbridge Stewart, for once in his life, simply didn't have the need to know. I thought the Canadians shut all that down at the end of the Cold War. As far as we're aware, they did, but the Canadians neither confirm nor deny it. They don't think we know anything about it, and I admit we don't know much. Where it is, that they have a base there, but nothing about what they do there. The only thing visible on satellite images is a lake with a dam on it. Everything else is either underwater or underground. He sighed. The only thing that seems sure is that if you find the Canadians, man, you'll find Cammy. I gave the Brigadier a thoughtful look. So the idea is that you give me the coordinates for this place, and Zoner and I go tearing off to bust in and get her out. And if any member of our IAM force is captured or killed, the Director, Secret Intelligence, will disavow any knowledge of our actions. The Brigadier gave me his slightly tired smile again. "That's about the size of it," he said. By now, we'd reached the house again. The uniformed driver standing next to Lethbridge Stewart's car came to attention as we approached. "Sorry to keep you waiting, Sergeant Benton," the Brigadier said. He looked at Benton for a second, then glanced around. "Sergeant Benton?" "Sir," Benton replied. "Where's Sanders?" Without batting an eye, Benton replied stolidly, "She's in the car, sir." Lethbridge Stewart and I both glanced at the car. I don't know about him, but I couldn't see anybody in the passenger compartment. "Ah," said the Brigadier with a slight smile. "Very good." Then he turned to me and handed me a USB flash drive. "That's everything we know about the matter. Use your Spectrum Reserve cipher key to open it." I tucked the drive away. "Thanks. Now let's talk price." Lethbridge Stewart blinked, uncharacteristically taken aback. "I'm kidding," I assured him. "It's how I keep my spirits up when I've just learned that a friend has disappeared on a suicide mission." He accepted the barb, knowing that in doing so he was only acting as a proxy for M, and smiled slightly again. "Here's hoping it wasn't," he said. Then he shook my hand and said sincerely, "Good luck, my boy." "Thanks," I said. "I'll need it."